Okay, the first case today is United States v. Upshaw. Appellant's counsel ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, sir.
Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. Good morning, my name is Lieutenant Clifton Morgan III, and I represent the appellant in this case, Petty Officer Darius Upshaw. Chief Judge Stuckey, I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. One of the last statements the members heard before deliberating came from the trial counsel in rebuttal. He said, "Are there people in our world with propensity for sexual assault? Yes, there are. Is Petty Officer Upshaw one of those people? Yes, he is." And throughout his closing and rebuttal arguments, the trial counsel repeatedly urged the members to find Petty Officer Upshaw had a predisposition to commit the charged offenses by applying a preponderance of the evidence standard, effectively waving the judge's improper propensity instruction around as a sword. Now, this court should rule in Petty Officer Upshaw's favor for 3 reasons. The first 2 reasons relate to issue 1, the Hills error. The last issue relates to issue 2, the issue of judicial recusal. First, the trial counsel exploited the judge's confusing Hills instructions. Second, the government's case was weak in this case. And third, the substantive involvement of the military judge after recusing himself risks undermining the public's confidence in our judicial process. Now, the lower court found that the judge's instruction violated Hills. So all this court has to decide is prejudice. In answering that question, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. So that means even if there is a reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to the conviction, then the error is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. You look at the trial counsel's use of this instruction in this case. He exploited the instruction, therefore cementing the member's confusion. The lower court found that the trial counsel, quote unquote, capitalize on the parallels between the two charged offenses, the one between KLM and the one between KI. Between the two incidents, and not only that, the trial counsel encouraged the members to find predisposition and propensity in Petty Officer Upshaw's conduct. Now, you look at some of the quotes that the trial counsel made in closing and rebuttal. He said, he goes to a bar, sidles up a Marine, safe, sober ride home, he assaults them. It's what he does, that's the type of person he is. He also says this trial is unique because of the military judge's propensity instruction. He says, remember that propensity instruction, though, members. He also says, keep in mind, once you find by a preponderance of the evidence that any of the offenses have occurred, you can use that to draw the conclusion that he is the type of person that commits these offenses.
Lieutenant Morgan, let me ask you this. Which is your greater concern? The fact that the members were kind of repeatedly told and preached to about the propensity aspect of this, or is your concern more the fact that the members may very well have convicted the accused using the lesser standard of a preponderance of the evidence, or is it both?
Your Honor, it's actually both. It's all of that taken together. And that looks at both of these factors, right? So you're not only looking at the government's case, the strength of the government's case. That's a factor. But you're also looking at how the trial counsel used that instruction. So in looking at the standard here, whether there's a reasonable possibility that the instruction might have contributed to my client's conviction, yes, Your Honor. We're looking at the possibility that you have the trial counsel urging them to follow the military judge's instructions specifically for propensity, not only just propensity, but what distinguishes this case or what distinguishes Hills in general from Villatoro, the fact that they're asking them to use the preponderance of the evidence standard. Within 7 out of the 16 pages that you find in the record of trial covering rebuttal and closing arguments, they mentioned propensity, of course, well throughout. It was very pervasive, but not only that, they specifically referenced the preponderance of the evidence standard at least 6 times within those 7 pages, Your Honor.
The military judge ultimately gives the members the usual instruction that the argument of counsel are not evidence, and they are to pay attention to his instructions or her instructions on the law. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That happened in this case, didn't it? That happened here, didn't it? Didn't the military judge give that instruction?
Yes, Your Honor, it did happen here. But you look at, you're right, Your Honor, the members did say they will follow the judge's instructions, but you look at the judge's instructions in this case, and it was the exact same instruction that this court found erroneous in Hills. Not only that, this court found that same instruction was not only confusing to lay people being members, but was so confusing to even a trained lawyer wouldn't be able to somewhat decipher the confusion between the judge's instructions, allowing them or actually empowering the members to use the preponderance of the evidence standard in finding any of the offenses to support another charged offense. And that's the problem that we have in this case, because not only do you have the
counsel,
judge.
While the trial counsel soliloquized about preponderance of the evidence six times or whatever, however many times you said, did defense counsel object?
Your Honor, the defense counsel actually filed a motion early on when trial counsel was first trying to get the 413 propensity evidence admitted into court. So the defense did object then. But no, they didn't object.
No, they didn't object when he was hammering away.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But is your point then that defense counsel lost on that motion, but they had still preserved that on appeal?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, they did. And in preserving that, when you look at this standard and you look at, is there a reasonable possibility, you see that there is. So we talked about the pervasive use of the trial counsel's use of this instruction. And to the defense is actually unaware of any cases that this court has found to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt where the trial counsel did use the instruction. More importantly, especially when trial counsel used it in a way that was as pervasive as the trial counsel used it in this case. You even look at Prasad that was recently decided this year. This court found how the trial counsel used that instruction to be pretty important in its analysis. And when you even compare the trial counsel's use of the instruction in Prasad versus this case, the trial counsel actually used it in a more pervasive manner here.
Lieutenant Morgan, you mentioned that one of the things you were going to talk about is that the weaknesses in the government's case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you talk about that a little bit, at least from your vantage point?
Yes, Your Honor. So in looking at what is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, you can compare this case to some of those other cases in the past that this court has found was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. For example, you can compare this case to Luna, which this court actually affirmed because the lower court found that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In that case, you have a smoking gun, because in the cases that it has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, there has to be overwhelming evidence. So in that case, you had a corroborating witness who actually saw the assault. Not only that, you had incriminating text messages from the accused, and you didn't have the trial counsel referencing the instruction. But in this case, this is a he said, he said case. It's nothing more than that, Your Honor.
But we've never said that the requirement is that it must be must be overwhelming evidence, have we? It just simply happened to be in those cases.
Yes, Your Honor. You look at Williams and Guardado. It said that it has to be overwhelming evidence in order for it to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But in doing so, this court also has to look at the presentation of the government's case at trial and how they presented the package of their case.
Isn't this a bit more than he said, he said? I mean, we have the demeanor of the victim afterwards, the excited utterances, the phone calls, the texts to a squad leader and team leader. And we have that statement by the appellant about survivor syndrome, which could show a consciousness of guilt. So it's a little bit more than he said, he said. Maybe not overwhelming, but certainly more than a simple he said case.
Not really, Your Honor, because you do have the text message. You do have a copy, a screenshot of the phone records. However, all of that evidence is just repetitive. That's actually a repetition of what the alleged victim is telling other people. So in actuality, that evidence isn't independent evidence of the alleged victim's statements. And when you look at what Your Honor pointed out about the statement that Petty Officer Upshaw made, this court, that really isn't a consciousness of guilt in our perspective. And when you look at everything else that Petty Officer Upshaw did that night, it wasn't actions of someone who is of guilt. But bringing it back to the standard, Your Honor.
Counsel, could I follow up on Senior
Yes.
Judge Crawford's question? As you know, in the CCA opinion, it says the evidence of the appellant's guilt is, quote, overwhelming. And it also refers to, quote, we find no reasonable cause to question Lance Corporal KLM's credibility. Could you address that in the context of the quality and quantity of the evidence here? How are we to square what the CCA said in its opinion with this phase of your argument right now?
Yes, Your Honor. You look at the NMCCA's opinion, and you know, even one of the facts that they rely on in showing that you know the alleged victim's testimony was credible, quote unquote, there's a clearly erroneous finding of fact here. You look in the court's opinion on page 12, and they actually found that, you know, the alleged victim, KLM, actually woke up after his jeans were unzipped. But that's not actually the testimony of what the victim said at trial. You look on page 93-94 of the joint appendix, and the alleged victim actually said, I woke up as he was unzipping my pants, not after. And so that even brings it to a whole different conclusion here, because you have what the alleged victim is saying, Petty Officer Upshaw, after 12 a.m., right before 1 a.m., is navigating his way through bays, driving with one hand, still focusing, being able to find his zipper underneath a huge cowboy belt buckle that he described was the size of a softball, able with one hand to get that zipper. And as he is unzipping, that's when the victim wakes up. And he watches as he unzips his pants, watches as he finds the hole, puts his hand through the hole, grabs his penis, and starts moving in a masturbatory-like motion. And then and only then does the alleged victim says he can't push him off. He's too drunk to push him off or moves over. And so when you look at that in the totality, Your Honor, the offenses themselves or the allegations themselves is highly unlikely to have occurred. And whether this court believes that the allegation or these allegations are impractical, that's not the standard. This isn't a factual sufficiency analysis. It's not even whether this court finds that the convictions likely happen beyond a reasonable doubt. It goes beyond that.
Well, it sounds like you're trickling over into factual sufficiency here, and we don't do that.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's precisely my point. And that's not what this analysis is. It goes beyond that, looking at the totality
of
the
accountability. Well, you said, you know, if we find that he unzipped his pants while driving, well, that's a fact. We got to take what the trier of fact said as fact. We can't redo that.
Yes, Your Honor, but it also goes to the weight or the strength of the government's case alone. And answering Your Honor's question about the credibility of the witness. And when you look at this court's opinion in Williams, this court found that three of those specifications were actually not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in those specifications, this court found that those victims' testimonies were credible. However, again, they only had, even the corroborating witnesses could only tell what the victim was able to tell them, which is exactly what you have in this case.
Counsel, would you briefly address Issue 2?
Yes, Your Honor. So moving to Issue 2, if this court does not find, or if this court gets to Issue 2, this court answer that question clear in Roach. It says either a military judge is recused or he's not. That's what this boils down to. Now, in answering that question,
Counsel, before you address that, could you tell us about the relationship of Issue 1 to Issue 2? Is it your position that if we rule in favor of the appellant on either one of these issues, that we reverse? Or do we have to address both issues?
Your Honor, our position is that this court should actually address both issues. Again, if this court finds that Issue 1 is dispositive, that will set aside Petty Officer Upshaw's findings and sentence for both. However, when you look at this judicial recusal issue, it is a published opinion by the MCCA, one that we find to be highly erroneous, and therefore we ask that this court actually address that issue as well, even if it was to find the first issue dispositive. And so, looking
at... Let me ask you that. Why are you concerned about that? Isn't your job to be worried only about your client's situation? If we, and I'm not suggesting we will, but if we rule in favor of the defense on this first issue, why is there a need to go to the second issue?
Your Honor, there isn't a it's not necessary. There isn't a need for this court to do that. And this court very well, absolutely.
Right, but what equities would the defense and your client have in the fact that there may be a recusal issue somewhere embedded in the case? Isn't that for the government and the lower court to worry about? I mean, haven't you already won if you win?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. And this court does not have to answer the second issue if it answers the first. And looking at in this case, the third Liegeberg factor controls, and that's that there is a risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process. You had not only the recused judge acting in this case, but you also had his successor seeking his opinion in this case. And whether that opinion controlled, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I have a moment to
finish your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, whether the recused judge's actions influenced the second judge or not, that's not dispositive in this case. In fact, this court found in Roach that's immaterial to this court's analysis. And for those reasons, this court should set aside Petty Officer Upshaw's findings and sentence for charge one involving KLM. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Suki, may I shift the timer just so I can see it?
Sure.
Chief Judge Suki, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Joshua Fiveson, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Nick Gannon, I represent the United States. This court should affirm for two reasons. First, the overwhelming strength of the United States' case demonstrates that the Hill's error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And second, the timing of the military judge's failure to recuse demonstrates that appellant was not prejudiced and Article 59A bars relief. To the first issue, the strength of the United States' case should leave this court confident that there was no reasonable probability the Hill's error contributed to the verdict. Williams, United States versus Williams, is in this respect instructive.
Do we look only at the strength of the government's case, or do we look at the, admittedly, rather confusing nature of the instruction?
Your Honor, the latter.
I mean, the government can have what it says is a strong case, but if the members are sitting there slack-jawed because they don't even know what standard is, what's the effect of that?
Yes, Your Honor. So the latter speaks to error, which in this case the United States concedes that there was Hill's error.
Yeah.
The former question as to what role the strength of the United States' case plays.
Well, wait a minute. It's not that it's error, but it's error in the sense, in a very, very fundamental, almost structural sense, in that the members don't know do they have to convict this guy by HBO, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, which the judge eventually, of course, said? Or is there some preponderance of the evidence thing floating around here? Or do you use one for part and another for the other part?
Well, Your Honor, I mean,
that looks like structural error to me, but go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'd note first that this court has not held Hill's error as structural error.
Right. You are correct.
Which is an incredibly limited doctrine. But more importantly, as this court has routinely affirmed, the strength of the United States' case, specifically where the case is overwhelming, can demonstrate that the Hill's error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And
can I ask you a point on that? And it's kind of a follow-up to Chief Judge's question. If there is a Hill's error, does it necessarily mean that the accused might very well have been convicted on a standard below beyond a reasonable doubt? That's the first question.
Yes, that is the risk with Hill's error, and the court next turns to prejudice to determine whether or not the court is confident that that did not bear out.
I understand, but on the issue of having been convicted on a lesser standard, doesn't that bring some constitutional issues into play?
Yes,
Does the accused have a constitutional right to make the government prove the case against him beyond a reasonable doubt? And if they do that, and the conviction cannot, and if they do not do that, the conviction cannot stand, right?
So, yes and no, Your Honor. Yes, Hill's error is constitutional, which is why this court, in every case involving Hill's error, reviews for harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. But the notion that the government cannot overcome that error by showing the overwhelming strength of its case is where we would part ways, Your Honor. As this court affirmed in Williams, for example, there, the United States' case was overwhelming, namely because it introduced evidence of the circumstances surrounding the abuse.
I understand that, but my question is more fundamental, and I may be stepping on the toes of judges who've come before me, for sure. But if the accused is not convicted under the proper constitutional standard, how does the overwhelming nature of the evidence correct that or remedy that?
Well, Your Honor,
you still, no matter how strong the evidence is, the accused, as it turns out, will still have been convicted below the standard that the Constitution requires.
Your Honor, with respect, what that does is fold the question of error and prejudice into one another. So the question of error, first, is whether or not the instruction invited that constitutional departure. And the United States, again, in this case, this was the instruction in Hills.
So you're backing up a little bit, and I understand, maybe I wasn't clear. Inviting the instruction might invite the members unwittingly to use a different standard, but it may not necessarily mean they used that standard?
Precisely, Your Honor.
I got you.
And that's where prejudice comes up, which is where the government's case is overwhelming. This court, as in Williams, can safely conclude that it's confident that the erroneous instruction did not contribute to the ensuing verdict. And in that regard, I would just note the three categories of evidence that came in similar to Williams, and which was held overwhelming. First, texts, call logs, and testimony from two different witnesses corroborated the victim's immediate, consistent reports to different people that appellant had, quote, tried to rape him, that he, the victim, needed help, and that he wanted that help to hurry up. The United States also introduced evidence from three corroborating witnesses that attested to the victim's intoxication, as well as the fact that the victim was under extreme emotional duress during all periods of consciousness following his immediate, consistent reports of abuse. And finally, like Williams, the members received evidence that appellant himself also confirmed the major aspects of the victim's report, pending, with the exception, of course, of the sexual abuse itself. And I would highlight that this case is unlike Hills or Prasad. In Hills, where the United States introduced no corroborating evidence, and the 32 officer recommended against the preferral of charges, or Prasad, where the evidence supported a reasonable mistake of fact defense, and the evidence also supported a motive to fabricate, making it, in the words of this court, a close case. But this was not a close case. And that fact distinguishes trial counsel's references to the erroneous instruction from those referenced by my colleague in Prasad. Prasad being a case which stands in the United States' estimation for the proposition that the line between constitutional harmlessness and prejudice is more simply crossed, the balance more easily tipped, where the government's case is not overwhelmingly strong. But this is not that case. And I would also note, Judge Sparks, as you referenced, there was preached to as to the instruction. The United States would respectfully suggest that it was not as expansive.
I agree.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Sparks.
I may have overstepped myself in a moment of overzealousness.
Well, it happens to the best of us, sir. But the United States' point is that this, by appellant's own estimation, was 19 lines of 441 lines, admittedly over the course of 16 pages, which reduces to about 4% of the argument. And that is simply insufficient to overcome the overwhelming nature of the government's case. And I would close on issue one by just echoing this court's own words in Prasad. To say that an error did not contribute to the ensuing verdict is not to say that the members were completely unaware of the error. Instead, this court need only find that the error was unimportant in relation to everything else. That's exactly what we are presented with here, and for that reason, appellant's first claim fails. Now,
before you move on, can I beat this horse one more time? I know he's breathing heavily, but I need to beat him one more time.
Yes, sir.
And that is where we started with my original question, which was, does the finding of Hill's error necessarily yield a conclusion that the accused was convicted under an unconstitutional standard? And your response, I just want to clarify, your response is that, well, maybe not, because the mistake is that the instruction may very well invited the members to, but there's always the possibility that they did not, and they used the proper standard.
Precisely, Judge.
I got you. Thank you, sir.
And to hold otherwise would merge error into prejudice, and this court has not done that prior. Now, if I could turn to the second issue. Though the military judge erred in discussing pending motions with a previously recused judge, the timing of that error demonstrates that appellant was not prejudiced, and Article 59A, therefore, bars relief. Now, before discussing the Liljeburg factors, which, as I'll address in a moment, unanimously weigh against appellant's requested relief, I'd like to first address why the lawful balance set by Congress in Article 59A should compel this court to hold, as a matter of first impression, that the first Liljeburg factor is a threshold question and a necessary prerequisite to relief. Now, it goes without question that Article 59A and Article 67 bookend this court's authority. Yet this court has never resolved Liljeburg against that statutory backdrop, as it has, for example, in Powell, in the context of Olano's Article 3 plain error test. And I would also note that this court has rejected Olano's fourth public reputation prong on the basis that Olano interpreted a federal rule which conferred discretion, and this court held that simply had no place in the military justice system. But I would note that Liljeburg rests on the exact same foundation. Liljeburg, a case interpreting a federal rule of civil procedure, vacature, that confers discretion for Article III courts to, quote, do justice in exceptional circumstances. And this statutory oversight has produced, the United States would respectfully suggest, irreconcilable precedent. On one hand, Martinez suggesting that 59A and Liljeburg are independent alternatives for relief, whereas Roach, Butcher, McElwain, and beyond suggesting that the Liljeburg factors are themselves independent means of discovering Article 59A prejudice, without acknowledging the fact that two-thirds of that test is explicitly unmoored from substantive prejudice on an individual case, irrelevant to the outcome. And I would also note that the service courts have simply magnified the schism, the Army endorsing the former approach, the independent alternative to 59A, the Air Force, I believe, as this court will hear later today, endorsing the latter approach, that Liljeburg is the three prongs that independently discover 59A prejudice, and unfortunately the Navy endorsing both. In Bremer and Upshaw, on one hand the alternative, on the other Liljeburg is the test.
Do we need to get into all this if we just decide one?
Well, Your Honor, if this court decides that the government's case was not overwhelming,
right,
then yes, there would be no need to reach this issue.
There's no need to get into all this.
However, I would say 2 points. First, of course, it's our estimation that this case was overwhelming. It's
right.
Identical to Williams, and for that reason, this court should reach the second issue. And I would also suggest, somewhat similar to my colleague, that even if the court disagrees with us as to the first issue, this inconsistency in the precedent is deserving of clarity to the field and would be worth at least noting if the court is disinclined from addressing it on the merits. But it's the government's position that this court should. And
Charles, may I ask you about the government's position? We find ourselves in an unusual position where we're hearing two cases today, Upshaw and Uribe, and the United States government is presenting two different arguments on this specific issue. What is the government's position? Is it your position, or is it the position that we anticipate hearing later this morning?
Your Honor, our position is not inconsistent with the Air Force's to the extent, and again, I don't want to argue on behalf of the Air Force, nor do I think they would let me, but the Air Force is suggesting that the Liljeburg factors weigh exclusively against relief in the next case. And it's our position, which is consistent with that, that where that's the case, the statutory threshold has not been met, and therefore appellant is not entitled relief under 59A. So though they are certainly different hues, they're the same color, Your Honor. And the point is here, every single prejudice test, save Liljeburg, it seems, resonant throughout the prejudice test, is that error is reversible where there's a reasonable probability that that error contributed to the outcome. This is the case whether the error is constitutional or non-constitutional, preserved or forfeited. And we can see this in standards such as Chapman, Strickland, Kerr, Alano, across all of them with the exception of Liljeburg. And it's the United States' respectful suggestion that this case presents the ideal vehicle in order to clarify this and resolve Liljeburg once and for all against this court's statutory backdrop, that is 59 and 67. To do so, Alano's fourth public reputation factor is actually somewhat instructive. There, Article III courts only consider it after having found prejudicial error.
We beat ourselves to death on Alano's fourth prong, and I doubt that anyone, including me, who was for it, wants to go there again.
Yes, Chief Judge Stuckey. And this case isn't a vehicle to readdress that, as you did in Tunstall and Tovar Chavez. The point is the statutory mandate of 59 would compel a similar approach in that space. But on this backdrop, to address the Liljeburg factors themselves, two points demonstrate that the first Liljeburg factor weighs against appellant, and there is no injustice in this case. First, the military judge's failure to recuse was mooted by the convening authority's intervening withdrawal and dismissal of the affected specifications. The military judge discussed pending motions with the previously recused judge, and that, of course, as the NMCCA found, was the recusal error. But shortly thereafter, and before the military judge ruled on those motions, the convening authority withdrew and dismissed the affected specifications, thereby mooting not only the need to rule on the motions, but any claim of prejudice as well. And I would echo appellant's sentiment for the NMCCA when he said the risk of injustice in this case is, quote, relatively low. But more than relatively low, it's non-existent by virtue of the intervening withdrawal and dismissal. I would also add that as in Butcher, the timing of the recusal error left the military judge with no real substantive exercises of discretion within the remaining court-martial. In fact, the only real substantive exercise of discretion was on appellant's challenges for cause, all of which were granted by the military judge. Now, to the second Liljeburg factor, risk of injustice in other cases, this factor also weighs against appellant's requested relief. In part, this is informed by appellant's own failure to argue this factor. But even were that not the case, there's no legitimate claim of otherwise here. As in Martinez and Butcher, the United States does not take issue with the error, and that weighs quite heavily in favor of suggesting that no other cases would have as a risk to them. Now, on the third factor, which appellant relies exclusively on, that also does not weigh in favor of appellant's requested relief for a couple of reasons. First, appellant conflates error under 902A with Liljeburg's third prong, and though they seem similar, this court in Martinez clearly counseled that they are not the same. Liljeburg's third factor looks to the military justice's system as a whole, writ large, once the error is identified. And here, appellant's process throughout this process has been nothing short of far-reaching, fair, and favorable. Now, I would also note that this case is unlike McElwain, where the recusal error infused the entirety of the court-martial. It's also unlike Roach or Witt, where in those cases it infused the entire appellate proceedings. And I would note finally that, again, this court, the United States invites this court to resolve the tension between Liljeburg and the statutory backdrop of this court's authority. And doing so does conflict with some of the reasoning in this court's prior case law, to the extent that this court has relied fairly heavily on the third factor. But critically, this does little damage to the holdings of this court. I would note in Witt and in McIlwain, for example, both cases involve facts that where the public confidence issue at hand was actually coupled with individualized prejudice. I would note in Witt, this court commented, there could be no greater demonstration of individualized prejudice than the reimposition of a previously vacated death penalty. And in McIlwain, where the error, again, as I mentioned, infused the entirety of the court-martial, and the military judge exercised countless moments throughout the trial, various exercises of discretion. That simply is not this case. And for that reason, there is no claim of individual prejudice or injustice to this appellant. There's no risk to other cases. And finally, the public's confidence is not at risk. And this case presents the ideal vehicle to state affirmatively and resolve the conflict in this court's case law that the first Liljeburg factor, injustice to this appellant, is a prerequisite to the remaining analysis and a prerequisite to relief. Now, pending...
Counsel, can you explain that point? What is, if it all turns on Article 59A, what are the other two Liljeburg factors for?
Yes, Your Honor. So as the Supreme Court commented in Liljeburg, there is no draconian mandate where a court has found recusal error. So practically, you're right, Your Honor. All that is the prerequisite is the injustice to this appellant. However, the other factors, as the Supreme Court has used them, would weigh toward what remedy this court provides in a situation where it has identified individualized prejudice. But as a matter of authority, this court need only find individualized prejudice under prong one, injustice to the appellant, in order to get into the space of providing relief. The only question becomes what that relief will be, Your Honor, and the other factors inform that. Now, pending any further questions from the court, I see that I still have some more time, but I would conclude.
Thank you, counsel.
Chief Judge Stuckey, in the court, the United States would ask that you resolve the first issue in favor of the United States because the overwhelming strength of the government's case demonstrated beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no reasonable probability the instructional error contributed to the conviction. And second, this case is the ideal vehicle to hold that the first Liljeburg factor is a prerequisite to relief, and even not, appellant fails all three Liljeburg factors, and for that reason merits no relief, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, 3 points. To Joe Sparks' question to the government in regarding the error and prejudice of the instruction, if there was even a possibility that the members used that erroneous standard, that means it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The government made a point to try to liken this case to Williams, but this case is not...
Is that the standard? Or is the standard that the government has overwhelming evidence and that just scotches the whole thing? This argument has left me totally confused. What is the standard for this when you've got this kind of error?
Yes, Your Honor. The standard is that the government has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
They have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't affect...
Correct, Your Honor.
That it didn't affect the members' deliberations.
Correct, Your Honor.
Sentence.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court in Hill said if there is a reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to the members' instructions or the conviction, then it is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That was this court's statement in Hills. And so that is the standard. And so you have to look at the entirety of the government's case, how they presented their case at trial. And the government tried to liken the case to Williams, but this is not Williams. In Williams, you don't have any reference of the trial counsel using the propensity instruction as a sword as they did in this case.
In Williams, you also have a sworn statement by the accused. In this case, the accused, Petty Officer Upshaw, pled not guilty. There aren't any incriminating statements here like there was in even Prasad that made the case close. He didn't testify at trial, so you don't really have any statements from the accused in this case that were incriminating, such as the ones in Williams. And then on top of that, lastly, the government presented photographic evidence of other things that cooperate with victims' injuries and statements. But in this case, again, all you have is the alleged victim's repetitive statements of the allegations, which, of course, is not independent evidence. And so moving to the second issue being judicial recusal, the government's position would make the legal concept of recusal meaningless. So when you're looking at the third Liederberg factor, the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process, the Supreme Court said that the appearance of justice must satisfy the appearance of justice. And this court said in Roach that is all the more important when it comes to the military justice system. And so Roach was also reaffirmed in Witt, Your Honor. And I see I'm out of time. May I have a moment to conclude?
Yes, please.
So consistent with Witt, Roach satisfies Article 59A because the injustice is to the appellant's right to have an impartial judge both in fact and in appearance. And this court should set aside appellant's findings and sentence for KLM because the government's evidence was not overwhelming and is not consistent or likened to Williams. And this court should also, if it gets to the second issue, which it does not have to, find that the judge's involvement here was prejudicial to the appellant's rights under Liederberg, the third factor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the case is now submitted. I erred when we started out today in not recognizing the presence with us of Senior Judge Susan Crawford, former Chief Judge of this court, former occupant of my chambers. We're very, very happy to have Susan sitting with us today for what I think is the first time since she left the court as Chief Judge. We thank her very much for her assistance. Court is now in recess until 10:45.